listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
It's been nearly 3 years since Lloyd Minor took the helm as the dean of the Stanford University School of Medicine. In that time, some exciting and significant changes have taken place at Stanford Medicine and beyond. New support for fundamental and translational research, the strengthening of the Stanford Medicine identity, and new partnerships with leadership at Stanford's two hospitals, and laying the groundwork for a bold new vision to lead the biomedical revolution in precision health. In this podcast, Dean Minor will discuss some of the highlights of his tenure to date, the collaborative culture that is so unique here, his commitment to diversity, and his vision for the future of Stanford Medicine. A scientist and a surgeon, Dean Minor is the Carl and Elizabeth Naumann Dean and Professor of Otolaryngology at Stanford. Dean Minor, thank you for joining me on One to One.
Thank you, Paul.
You're in your third year here. In that time, what have you learned about Stanford?
I've learned that Stanford is even a more amazing place than I thought it was before I came here. The depth and breadth of excellence in the faculty and the students is just extraordinary. And the level of excitement and engagement that we have with our future and the future of the world that we're impacting is palpable every day. This is an extraordinarily exciting place to work, a place where it's easy to get out of bed in the morning with enthusiasm about what lies ahead in the day. And I think that really characterizes what's so unique and special about Stanford. The shared vision and values that we have across the university, the strong sense of community that exists here. This is really an impactful place to work, a place where I think all of us sense that the work we're doing is having impact in our community and impact in our world.
I've heard you talk about Stanford Medicine's vision to lead the biomedical revolution. Can you explain more, as you see it, what is the biomedical revolution?
The biomedical revolution is the convergence of expertise from multiple disciplines, convergence onto the study of biomedical problems and situations. For example, today, two-thirds of the faculty in the chemistry department in the School of Humanities and Sciences here at Stanford, it's an outstanding department, you know, nationally, internationally ranked. Two-thirds of the faculty today are doing biologically focused research. Not because someone has told them they have to focus on biological problems, but that's where the really interesting, challenging problems that are drawing the faculty in to study them, that's where the problems are located today, is in biology. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was meeting with my colleague, Persis Drell, the dean of the School of Engineering, and Persis was remarking that as she's gotten to know her faculty, she's been dean of engineering now for a year, as she's gotten to know her faculty, she estimates that at least 30% are doing biomedically focused work, and that proportion focused on biomedicine will most likely be increasing in the future because the searches that they're doing, although they typically do broad, open area searches, many of the candidates are seeing are biomedically focused. And that extends not only to the bioengineering department, where you'd of course expect that faculty and students would be biomedically focused, but it extends to departments like mechanical engineering and electrical engineering, and of course computer science. We see these periods in history where the technologies, the sort of baseline knowledge, all of these factors come together to make it particularly propitious to study a group of problems. In the 19th century, it was chemistry, fundamental chemistry. And then the 20th century was certainly the century of physics. And I think the 21st century is going to be the century of biomedicine.
As you look to the future of Stanford Medicine, what are you most enthusiastic about?
I'm enthusiastic about our opportunity to tackle problems that we know today, and probably of equal or greater excitement, problems that we haven't even thought of today, to tackle them and come up with solutions and advances that really do lead in new directions. And the theme that emerged from our strategic planning that Amir Rubin, Chris Dawes, and I led over the past 12, 18 months, the theme that we came up with for that plan is leading the biomedical revolution in precision health. And we view precision health as being the next generation of precision medicine. Precision health incorporates precision medicine, but it doesn't stop there. So what's the difference? Well, precision medicine, and we've heard a lot about that, of course, it's a major initiative from the Obama administration. It's a major priority for Francis Collins and other leaders at the NIH. Precision medicine is about bringing genomic knowledge, about bringing knowledge of the phenotypic characteristics of disease, bringing it all together to better treat acute diseases in each individual. So it's about individualizing and personalizing care based upon knowledge. So no longer will a person with this general type of tumor receive a standard chemotherapy or radiation protocol that was developed based upon 100,000 patients, many with widely different, you know, genomic characteristics of their tumors, different characteristics of their health in other ways, that having a quote, standard care that was based upon an overly simplistic view of the disease in that person. So being able to individualize therapy based upon precise information about the individual and how their makeup impacts their disease. But it's disease focused. For sure we want to do that, and we are doing it. A major initiative here in cancer, where I think we're driving a lot of advances. But we don't want to stop there. We want to look before disease actually occurs. We want to look for predictors of disease. We want to be proactive in healthcare through what we're doing with My Heart Counts, that app that allows each of us to interact with our data, through what we're doing in genomics to look at more accurate predictors of disease, as well as more accurate ways of detecting very early stages of disease so that it can be preempted or arrested very, very early before it gets to that acute disease treatment stage that precision medicine focuses on. So I'm most excited about doing that. I think we have an opportunity to develop the field of precision health. We can leverage the networks of care that we're building, the way we're reaching out into communities in Northern California, through the community-based practices we're building, through the electronic medical record that integrates all of those practices, again, leveraging our strengths in informatics and our emerging strengths in clinical informatics. We have the opportunity to put it all together here in ways that I don't think anyone else really does. So I'm really excited about that. I'm excited about the people that we have here today and the people that we hope will be joining us in the future. In the end, the success of any strategic plan is dependent upon the people and the engagement of people in the plan and really making it a reality and much more than something on paper.
What do you see as the most important values of Stanford Medicine?
I believe our most important values are commitment to excellence, a drive always to achieve excellence. Certainly for Stanford, innovation is a critically important value in everything we do. We're not much attracted, and I hope we never are much attracted to doing things that are incremental. For sure, there's a role for incremental advances, but our unique strengths are in being able to come up with paradigm-shifting advances. I think we value now, and I hope that we value even more in the future, diversity. Diversity in all of its aspects. I'm really pleased that in this year's incoming PhD class, 28% of the students entering our PhD class are from underrepresented minority groups. In our medical school class, it's approximately 22%. 57% of our incoming medical school class this year are women. So we're doing, I think, a marvelous job, always room for improvement, but an excellent job in student programs. We're making progress in faculty. In a lot of areas, in achieving faculty diversity, we have to build the pipeline for that. And of course, one way we do that is through our educational programs. But diversity is important. It's a way we lead as an institution. It's a way we impact the society in which we live. Also, another thing that I believe we value a great deal at Stanford and that we want to continue to foster is collaboration. This is an environment, the campus is designed to promote collaboration. As I mentioned, the new ChemH and Neuroscience Institute being just across the street from our research buildings in the School of Medicine, the new Bass Biology building being just across the street on the other side. We have people physically, geographically grouped in ways that they can interact with each other on a daily basis. And our ethos is one that really does encourage collaboration. And collaboration is going to undergird the biomedical revolution. Increasingly, the innovation is not so much going to come from one person or one approach. It's going to come from the melding together of many different approaches tackling very complex problems.
There's been a large discussion nationally about the expense of medical school and medical school education. And is Stanford Medicine doing anything about this concern, and how are you addressing it?
Yes, it certainly is a concern. A few ways we're addressing it. We do put in a significant amount of funding into financial aid. Our medical students, on average, graduate with a lower debt than our peer institutions. Our average debt is just over $100,000 a year, and at other medical schools in the United States, it's the average is well over $150,000 a year. I'm very pleased that in our incoming MD class, we offered 12 full tuition scholarships, and 9 of those included a full stipend for room and board as well, based upon financial need. We always have to be attentive to that. I believe that by keeping our debt low, our average graduating debt low relative to peer institutions, that the pressure students nationally feel to select a specialty based upon their income potential later on, especially, that pressure is lower here at Stanford than it is at most other places. But it's not non-existent, and we need to continue to work on providing additional financial assistance.
You have two key partners in Stanford Medicine, Amir Rubin of Stanford Healthcare and Chris Dawes of Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. Can you give me a snapshot of how you work together and how important it is to have these strong relationships?
It's extraordinarily important to have strong relationships. I believe we work together really well. I think the strategic planning process that we have been and continue to be engaged in has brought us much closer together. We have the shared vision of leading the biomedical revolution in precision health. Our case statement for that vision, we developed together, presented it together to the Stanford University Board of Trustees. We've come together to envision a master space plan for Stanford Medicine over the next 20 years that includes next steps in the rejuvenation of clinical facilities that began, of course, with the construction of these wonderful two new hospitals in our footprint, but looks forward also over the next 20 years of what we will need to do to continue that process of providing the very best clinical facilities for our patients, and also includes what we need to do to rejuvenate our research facilities. We're approaching all of these in an integrated fashion. For sure, we have to recognize the individual needs of the children's hospital, the adult hospital, and the school. But those are best recognized, I believe, and I believe we have universal buy-in to this notion today. Those are best recognized when we approach them together as an integrated entity. In the end, that's what we're all about. We are a school of medicine and two hospitals with one owner, and that's Stanford University. And I think the university has made it very clear to us that they want us to work together as an effective partnership, and that through that partnership, we'll continue to build the luster of the university.
Big data is driving a lot of discussions today in medicine. How is Stanford positioned uniquely to lead the way in using big data to transform healthcare?
I believe we're extraordinarily well positioned to lead in big data and biomedicine. In medicine, we've been able to build up on the enormous quantitative strengths at Stanford. And we founded the first bioinformatics PhD program about 25 years ago. It remains, I think, the most competitive program and I believe the best program in bioinformatics in the country. We obtained approval from the Board of Trustees in June to launch a new department in the School of Medicine, the Department of Biomedical Data Science. We've had a strategic planning process for that new department this summer, and will be in the next few weeks launching the department and with a strategic plan for how we're going to recruit faculty to build upon the excellence we already have. Around Stanford, there is now an initiative called Data Science at Stanford that brings together data scientists from the School of Humanities and Sciences, the School of Engineering, the School of Earth, Energy, and Environment, the Business School, a variety of different places, of course, the School of Medicine, to really look in the broadest sense at how data science today is being manifested in individual schools and programs, and how we might build up core infrastructure that would benefit the programs in the various schools. Biology, since the discovery of DNA, the structure of DNA, really has been very hypothesis-driven. I'm going to teach a course with John Ioannidis, to a freshman seminar course in the winter quarter. The title of our course is The Scientific Method and Bias. And we'll start with a consideration of the work of Popper and of Thomas Kuhn and the structure of scientific revolutions. The notion is that for classic deductive science, you start with a group of hypotheses and you do experiments that disprove hypotheses. And the hypothesis that's left standing, the hypothesis that has not been disproven, is the hypothesis of the day, the month, the year, the decade, until something comes along and knocks it off, you know, when we have a new set of knowledge. And that remains the way most science is done. But today, because of the amount of data available, we have the opportunity to take a new approach to inference. And this is where data science comes in. We can look for relationships in between elements that we might have thought were completely unrelated. We do that all the time in genomics. Now, just because there's a relationship doesn't mean that there's causality, that A causes B. And that's where you move from inductive-based approaches back to the deductive world. But that focus on the theory and the analytical methods in this new data science, this new inductive science, that's something we can lead and drive here uniquely well.
NIH funding is stagnant, and it has been for several years, especially for young researchers, and there's a deep concern that this lack of funding will force scientists out of academic medicine and will lose the brightest and the best. How do you find ways to reward young scientists and make sure that their risk-taking endeavors don't fall into black holes?
Something we think about a lot. Again, it's related, as you mentioned in your questions, related to the fact that what distinguishes Stanford science and its innovation, discovery and innovation that distinguish science at Stanford from science at most other places. And yet that science is what is most threatened today in this tight federal funding environment. The joke, and unfortunately it's not a joke, it's a reality, is that in order to get an NIH grant today, you have to have already done all of the work, know the answers, and then write the grant. And unfortunately, it's pretty close to being correct. When you're doing really groundbreaking research, innovative research, you may not have an idea starting out what the answer is at all. In fact, you may feel like there's a high probability that the entire approach is going to fail. And yet, if you don't try it, you won't know. You won't be able to uncover the opportunities unless you take that first leap. Last year, we awarded about $2 million in innovation funds made possible by a very generous gift from a group of anonymous donors. A group of anonymous donors who understand that maintaining the innovative focus of Stanford science is absolutely critical to the leadership role that people expect Stanford to play in the science arena. So we awarded these grants. A faculty-led committee evaluated them. In sending out the request for proposals, we told people, you know, we don't want to see preliminary data. We want to see ideas. And we asked the faculty selection committee for the grants to choose the most innovative ideas and choose some ideas as well that are risky. Don't shy away from risk. Already we're seeing the benefits of that. We're seeing important discoveries coming from those proposals we funded. And yes, we're seeing a few proposals that have failed, that are not, but from the failure, there's been a lot of learning going on, and the next attempt will undoubtedly be better able to be successful. Providing that sort of funding, providing the funding that we're providing for PhD students to guarantee the first 4 years of PhD education, funded entirely from a combination of training grants and philanthropy. Those are ways that we give our faculty the baseline support and encouragement that's needed to do truly innovative work.
Stanford Medicine uniquely sits in perhaps one of the most innovative places on the planet, Silicon Valley, and its entrepreneurial spirit is renowned around the world. What are the collaborations and partnerships that you see developing now and in the future between Stanford Medicine and the range of companies in the Valley?
There are already many collaborations and partnerships that exist, and I think there will be even more in the future. We talked about a few earlier on, the My Heart Counts app that Tim Cook announced at an Apple event in San Francisco in March that now has over 45,000 people consented to upload their data. And this has been reported in the press several months ago, but we're collaborating with Google as well as with Duke on what's called the baseline study. It'll look at a variety of different health indicators in a large group of patients and then follow those large group of participants and follow those participants for many years. It will be the most comprehensive longitudinal cohort study ever done. Again, back to this notion of inference and data science, there will be relationships emerge from that study that we haven't even imagined today. And then that will fuel a whole new set of studies to see how many of those relationships apply to causality and how we can better understand indicators of disease. Because the baseline study will include people who are healthy as well as people who have specific diseases, we'll also be able to really start to build out the science and the meat around precision health. Because we're going to be studying people who are healthy today and looking longitudinally, be able to then detect indicators of early disease. Those are a couple. We have relationships, support from industry for faculty-led projects in a variety of different areas. We're always looking for those opportunities. Care has to be exerted because there are conflicts that have to be managed, and the goals of business can be different than the goals of an academic enterprise. But in so many areas, those goals and those mission areas align. We bring expertise, knowledge, focus that can be very beneficial to businesses. They bring support as well as scaling opportunities that don't typically fit within the profile of an academic institution.
Do you have a daily routine, and is there sort of a typical day for you?
I get up a little before 5, and I like to start every day out with exercise. I go to the gym 3 mornings a week at 5:30, and on the mornings I don't go to the gym, I try to get some type of aerobic exercise. But I find that that exercising early in the morning is a great way to start out the day. Once, you know, I come into the office after the gym or after exercising, and the days are pretty busy. They're typically long days. I have something going on most evenings related to Stanford. I'm pleased that most of those evening activities can include my wife, and so that's an opportunity for us to spend some time together in terms of the entertaining we do and the other events that we take part in. And then I try to preserve some time at the end of the day to do some reading, and also on the weekends as well. No 2 days are alike, and so this job is never dull. And I think, as I talk to my colleagues, one of the blessings of being in a place like Stanford is very few of us here have ever suffered the curse of boredom. So the days are filled with meeting with people associated with the various aspects of my job.
How do you relax?
I like to read and always try to keep a few things going in terms of things that I'm reading. I like historical nonfiction. I like scientific books that present science and fields I'm not familiar with, but in a way that I can understand. I like biographies and autobiographies. And the other way I exercise is relaxing on the weekends. I like to hike with our dogs. Enjoy spending time with my wife. And when our kids are back in town or when we're visiting them, then spending time with them. I like classical music. I used to play the cello quite a bit. I don't play as much anymore, but I still enjoy listening to classical music. And with the Bing Concert Hall here and the wonderful artists that are brought in, that's been a big addition to my life, and I think for the Stanford community as well.
You mentioned you're a voracious reader. What's on your bookstand?
Just finished, and we talked about a couple of weeks ago with our incoming students, 5 Days at Memorial, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book written by Sherry Fink, who is an alumna of our medical school. She received her MD and PhD degrees from here. So well written and brings up so many dilemmas. In the extreme, because Katrina was the extreme, and let's hope that nothing like that happens again, but even when viewed in the extreme, you can see things in the events that happened in the 5 days after the storm that happen every day in a healthcare setting, not in the extreme form. And I just found it to be so informative and so thought-provoking. So we led a discussion of that for our incoming students and their families.
President Hennessy has announced that he's leaving. He'll be stepping down next June. Can you reflect on his presidency and legacy?
I think John leaves an enormous legacy at Stanford. Both he, John Hennessy, and John Etchemendy have in so many ways transformed this institution over the past 15 years. Got to know John Etchemendy when I was provost at Hopkins, and one of the things John Etchemendy said to me in a conversation that I had with him long before this job was that at the time of the last presidential transition, they brought in Bill Bowen, who had been the president of Princeton, a very distinguished leader in higher education in America, and that Bill Bowen evaluated Stanford. And one of the things he said to the trustees was, you know, Stanford is the only university he knew of that was less than the sum of its parts. He said, you have such great strengths here, but they seem to be in opposition to each other in many ways. And what John Etchemendy said to me, and then subsequently John Hennessy as I got to know him, was that the focus of their leadership had been to make Stanford as a whole greater than the sum of its parts. And I think they've clearly accomplished that through strengthening the vertical pillars, the schools, and the programs associated with the schools, and in parallel with that, building the horizontally connected interdisciplinary programs in ways that I think very few other institutions have been able to build. We talked about a couple of them before, the newest ones, ChemH and neuroscience. Both of those institutes bring together faculty and disciplines from around the university in a way that enables the institutes to attack problems with uniquely strong positions because of the talent that they bring together. We see it across the board in other areas too, in areas like energy and the environment, in the humanities, in the social sciences. There have been so many things done to strengthen the connectedness across Stanford University and to make that much more than just an institute on paper, but really a guiding ethos for the university. I think that will be the lasting legacy of John Hennessy and John Etchemendy. And the opportunities for building upon that are enormous. The opportunities to consider what is our global impact? What is it today and what could it be in the future? How do we continue to build a diverse university and encourage diversity and excellence in our society? How do we tackle some of the more challenging issues in our society today and do so in a way that a research university is uniquely able to do? So these are opportunities that exist now because of the tremendous work that's been done over the past 15 years.
Dean Minor, thank you for joining me on One-to-One.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One-to-One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.